Don't let's be beastly to the Germans when we've definitely got them on the run. Let us treat them very kindly, as we would a valued friend. We might send them out some bishops as a form of lease and lend. Let's be sweet to them and day by day repeat to them that sterilization simply isn't done. Let's help the dirty swine again to occupy the Rhine again, but don't let's be beastly to the Hun.
Now, at first glance, we just couldn't resist that. The worlds of espionage and show business may seem like opposite ends of a spectrum. One's all about secrecy, the other's all about the limelight. But these two worlds actually have quite a lot in common, as the voice you heard there of Noel Coward will show. They require high levels of creative thinking, improvisation, disguise, and role play, and there's a level of deception in each. Well, our last guest today has explored the links between espionage and show business and how a number, a big number actually, of industry, entertainment industry luminaries have tried their hand at spying. Christopher Andrew, with co-author Julius Green, has written Stars and Spies, Intelligence Operations and the Entertainment Business. Christopher's a professor of modern and contemporary history at Cambridge University and a fellow of the Royal Historical Society. Welcome, Christopher.
Good morning, or indeed, as I should say, well, I don't know whether it's good morning or good evening, but good day anyway.
Look, just to set us off, and with that gorgeous little taster from Noel Coward, which we'll reveal the reason why later, how similar are the worlds of espionage and entertainment, or what you call the two worlds of smoke and mirrors?
Well, there's a great similarity, and they require the same kind of skills. Noel Coward, we'll perhaps come back to him later. He's a good example of somebody who crossed the boundaries between the two. So all intelligence collection is based on deception to some degree. I mean, no spy goes up to someone in another country and says, "Hello, I'm a spy. Now, can I recruit you as an agent and get your secrets?" No, they pretend to be something else. So it's the skills that are required in the two professions, which are very similar. And this goes right back, just one example before we move on, but let's go right back to Elizabethan England, Elizabeth I, that is to say. Elizabethan England suddenly becomes, in the 1580s, the best in the world at both espionage and theatre. And the leading theatrical individual, the leading dramatist at that point, Christopher Marlowe, also became, at the age of 21, a spy. So from Elizabethan England onwards, there's been lots of overlap between the two professions.
There's so much in your book. There's so many examples, and I'm going to have to pick and choose. But really, in a way, it's an exercise in creating a fictional character, isn't it? You've written, it's an exercise in long-form role play. Both of them are.
That is precisely what we've written. It absolutely is. So, for example, everybody in Britain who joins MI5, which is our ASIO, the security service, or joins MI6, which is our ASIS, Foreign Intelligence Service, none of them, except the chiefs, can admit to being a member of either. So all of them have to pretend to be a member of something else, to have another occupation. So, you know, from day one, it's partly about acting.
Let us go to Christopher Marlowe, recruited to be a spy, and which it may have played a role in his untimely death.
It probably did, because he actually, during his lifetime, is more famous even than Shakespeare, although Shakespeare's only just beginning. But he's killed at 29. Now, we know that a couple of the people who were present at the brawl which led to his death were involved with British intelligence. We know that there were an awful lot of internal rivalries at that time, so we'll never know the answer, but it's quite likely that there is a connection at the very end of his life between the two things that he is most interested in.
Let's fast forward a few centuries, and you write about how one of the Marx brothers, Harpo, was used by the US government while he was touring the USSR in the 1930s. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, well, this is a story vividly told by Harpo. Because he didn't depend on speaking, just on acting, he actually went to Stalinist Russia and was astonishingly successful. He even had a double act on stage with Stalin's foreign minister. Now, he claims that the American ambassador gave him secret documents to bring back. He put this in his memoirs, which he taped to his thigh, and which explains why when he had a shower on the way back, he went back by boat. He had to keep one leg sticking out, and he handed them over when he got back. I think this is not too reliable.
You think it's a bit apocryphal, do you?
I'm afraid so, but it's still an interesting story. And what is astonishing, as I've said, is how, you know, at the height of Stalinist Russia, Harpo was extraordinarily popular.
It is surprising. Yes, he was, and it was that sort of wordless comedy that obviously appealed. And look, I suppose what that, well, even if it's half true, it's an example of hiding in plain sight, isn't it? Is that a useful skill that entertainers offer intelligence agencies? That they get through the door, they're trusted, they're there to entertain. Is that what it is?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if we just let's move briefly to France before we return to the Anglophone world. There is really no doubt that the best French spies, the ones that collected the most intelligence during the two world wars, were both female dancers. Estelle Gert in the First World War and Josephine Baker, born in America, but a French hero in the Second World War. And only at the end of last year, Josephine Baker was moved in, her remains were moved into the Pantheon, which is the place in Paris which has the tombs of France's greatest heroes, under 90 of them. Now, the last thing that anybody would have thought about Estelle Gert is that she's a spy. The last thing anyone would have thought about Josephine Baker. So what Josephine Baker is able to do, she's on de Gaulle's side during the Second World War, is to go around the world with, of course, a secretary. But the secretary was a high-ranking French intelligence officer. But nobody was interested in him. They were just interested in Josephine Baker. So hiding in plain sight is quite often a very good form of hiding.
And the business of, so you just listened and smiled and were sort of fawned over, and meanwhile you're absorbing all this information that maybe no one else was privy to.
Well, that's right. Let me give you a British example. The best-known circus owner in British history was a man called Bertram Mills, who's succeeded by his son, who took the business even longer, Cyril Bertram Mills. Now, the last thing that would occur to anybody is that the owner of Britain's leading circus, I mean, a household name for children as well as adults, was actually one of Britain's leading spies. But in the Second World War, he was the first case officer for probably the best double agent in the history of warfare, who he gave the codename Garbo to. But it wasn't until he was in his 80s that the fact that he'd been involved in espionage as well as the circus leaked out. Mm-hmm. So paradoxically, being in front of the limelight, like Estelle Gert, like Josephine Baker, like Cyril Bertram Mills, can be a very effective disguise so far as espionage is concerned.
Well, let me move to Noel Coward, who was involved in minor but quite colourful intelligence operations during the Second World War, sent to lobby influential Americans to encourage the US to enter the war. And, of course, we well know now how, you know, Churchill was just waiting for FDR to be able to sort of wrangle the politics to make that happen. Did Coward enjoy this?
He did. He thought he was very good at it. He wasn't terribly good at it, but he'd master the main secret. It was precisely because he was a star that he thought people would never suspect that he was a spy. But he was part of a group which worked for British Security Coordination. That was the official title at the beginning of the Second World War in New York, and whose main task was actually to try and influence American opinion and government opinion to join in. Let me give you just one example of the extraordinary, their extraordinary achievements. One of the theatricals who was involved alongside Noel Coward, a man called Eric Mashbetz. But Mashbetz went on to be head of BBC TV Light Entertainment. And he was an extraordinary lyricist with songs which are still remembered, like Those Foolish Things. So what did he do? He set up a forgery factory. And the forgeries included entirely bogus documents and maps showing that Nazi Germany was planning an attack on the Americas. Completely bogus. But it so fooled FDR, President Roosevelt, that he quoted this complete forgery by masterminded by a future head of BBC Light Entertainment in the last speech that he made before Pearl Harbor.
Good Lord, isn't that fascinating? I mean, let me just tell listeners that we're hearing these amazing tales from Christopher Andrew, who, with his co-author Julius Green, who's a theatre producer, has written Stars and Spies, Intelligence Operations and the Entertainment Business. And there's all sorts of surprises here. I might add, the FBI did come to suspect him, didn't they? So there was something that they were concerned about and opened a file on him, Noel Coward.
They did. Well, I mean, they were quite right, suspicious of what British Security Coordination was up to, trying to influence American opinion. But they did, however, get on extremely well with Cyril Bertram Mills, who, whilst being British circus owner, became, in the latter stages of the war, the main link between MI5 and the FBI in North America.
You also have researched the depiction of spies on screen, and you write that fictionalised portrayals of the world of espionage have led to a glamorisation of its work, which often bears little relation to reality. So James Bond is not your typical British spy, obviously.
James Bond is not typical British spy, but he is, after all, produced by a spy. What's striking is that intelligence is one of those rare professions in which fictional characters are far better known than real characters. So James Bond and Smiley are, I think, still the best-known spies in the world. Both of them created by real spies, but leading lives which had little to do with the lives of their authors.
Your evidence about the impact of Le Carré, John Le Carré, who of course did work for British intelligence for a while, and Graham Greene too, is absolutely fascinating. That Richard Moore, who is the newest announced chief of MI6, this is what you've got towards the end of the book. He told his Twitter followers, "I'll try to persuade some of you to come and work for MI6, but there are two exceptions." I just love this. Hashtag Bond or hashtag Smiley need not apply. They're splendid fiction, but actually we're hashtag secretly just like you. So these characters who were full of betrayal, you know, or there were betrayal done to them essentially by others and so on, is not the hallmark. MI6 doesn't like to think anyway it's the hallmark of good spycraft.
The great advantage for MI6, as it operates under the two names, has been, however, that Bond, in particular, has given British intelligence a global reputation, and a favourable global reputation. You know, most people, a majority of the world's population, have seen and mostly enjoyed Bond films, including the latest one. But I remember being told by one of Richard Moore's predecessors as head of British and Foreign Intelligence that his first operation as a young MI6 officer in Southeast Asia was to make contact with a tribal leader who was believed to speak no English. But anyway, when he went up to it, the tribal leader said, "Hello, Mr. Bond." No, that was probably the only phrase of English that he knew. But people, you know, don't automatically, when they see or go to the cinema and see a KGB officer, oh, I think I'm going to like him. Or if they see a CIA officer, they're more likely to think who's he planning to assassinate than anybody else. But in Britain, it's quite different. When Queen Elizabeth II, the London Olympics a decade ago, when she had to choose somebody to help her open the Olympics, who did she choose? She chose James Bond in the person of Daniel Craig. So there's film of it, and it was shown in Australia at the time. Bond comes to Buckingham Palace. Then they both go and get on a helicopter. And, of course, it is alleged that the woman who jumps out of the helicopter is a body double.
She's the Queen.
anyway, she lands in the middle of the O2 arena and enters the Royal Box. And I've been told by other people in the Royal Box that Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II had kept this so secret that not even the Duke of Edinburgh in the Royal Box had any idea that that's how she was going to arrive.
Really? Is that true? Oh, I'd love to believe that. look, I've just got a couple of quick questions. Is it particularly an English sort of predilection? Because I don't know whether you hear much about, say, CIA people. And is it, I mean, are the Chinese doing this now?
Well, I think it is. I think it is a British speciality. Don't forget that the most popular American TV spy series of the last 20 years, called The Americans, is actually about Russian spies who are pretending to be Americans, and that's based on a real operation, Operation Ghost Stories, and the 10 who were caught in 2010. So it's not just Britain, but I think it is a British speciality, and confirmed by the fact that there really isn't as popular a fictional spy as James Bond. And you know, he's, after all, been in the business for 60 years, longer than any real spy ever. Now, so far as we know, no leading, you know, J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI in the United States. He was head for almost 50 years, but it's still Bond who has the record. What's the current discussion about? Not that Bond might disappear, but just who's going to be the next actor?
Well, that was going to be my final gambit. What's your tip? Who's going to be the next James Bond?
I can give a tip, and I believe it's almost certainly wrong, but here's what I would do. Moneypenny in the current film is played by Naomi Harris. Now, my proposal is that she should be promoted to the Bond role.
Christopher Andrew, it's been lovely to talk to you, and we're going to leave listeners with a little more of the complex talents of Noel Coward. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For you can't deprive a gangster of his gun, though they've been a little naughty to the Czechs and Poles and Dutch. I don't suppose those countries really minded.
Yes, thank you, Christopher Andrew, very much. Speaking about he was the in-house historian, would you believe, for MI5. Isn't that a cute idea? Stars and Spies is his book, Intelligence Operations and the Entertainment Business.